The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's issue is a double issue for July 20, the week of, and July 27, 2020, the week of. It's titled One Last Chance. It does appear to have some illustration for its cover art, which is by Jill Pelto for Time. It's about climate change, the defining year for the planet by Justin Warland. And there are layers of the Earth. There is something that looks very blue, like a blue-gray, like a cloudy sky. It says global climate change over two centuries. It doesn't tell us which two centuries. But the next layer is a darker gray, kind of an icy color. And the next layer is more of an orange tan. The next layer is even layered or labeled land ice. It's blue-white. But next to it are a bunch of tall pine trees. Now, tall being relative to the whole photograph or photographic depiction. It says renewable energy consumption. And then there's sea level, which is, again, blue with some ice flows in it. Now, I was reading top to bottom as if we were looking at the sky through several layers of our planet's earthen structure into the oceans. So that was the cover art for this issue. Beginning with the brief opener, and subtitled The World. Security Law Brings a Chill to Hong Kong by Amy Gunia, that's G-U-N-I-A, Hong Kong. For months, the mosaics of sticky notes, posters, and artwork that dotted Hong Kong told a story of resistance. Pro-democracy protesters and supporters affixed messages of hope, solidarity, and demands for greater political freedom to so-called Lenin Walls, that's L-E-N-N-O-N, Walls, as protests rocked the city in 2019. But after June 30, when Beijing passed Hong Kong's national security law, the walls came down. Books written by pro-democracy leaders like Joshua Wong disappeared from public libraries. Activists deleted social media accounts. Demo Sisto, Wong's political party, disbanded. Nathan Law, a prominent activist and another key member of Demo Sisto, fled the city, saying his effort to draw international attention to the movement would likely be considered a crime under the new law. It has already brought a chilling effect and the fear to the political fear to Hong Kong. He tells Time. The legislation's full text, which targets secession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces, was not made public until after it became law. It was passed by the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress in Beijing. Outside the normal legislative process that semi-autonomous Hong Kong was granted under the One Country, Two Systems arrangement created when the UK retroceded the city to China in 1997. It gives authorities sweeping powers to crack down on dissent. Some cases can now be tried in mainland courts, and mainland security agents will operate openly for the first time. Since its passage, local authorities have expanded the reach of the law even further, adding warrantless searches and the power to ask internet providers to remove posts that violate the security law. The Hong Kong government and officials in Beijing have argued the law is necessary to restore order after violent protests over an extradition bill last year caused millions of dollars worth of damage and plunged the city into its first recession in a decade. Chief Executive Carrie Lam, that's L-A-M, who admitted she was not privy to the full text of the law until it was passed, has said the law will be used only against an extremely small minority of people. She added, "Surely, this is not doom and gloom for Hong Kong." But even as the legislation's impact is felt on the ground, the full extent of its consequences remains to be seen. Some experts say it is a devastating blow to the rule of law and unique freedoms that differentiate Hong Kong from mainland China and made it a global hub for business and banking. Jeffrey Wasserstrom, a University of California Irvine history professor specializing in China, says the law amounts to a de facto form of martial law, limiting speech and action. Other experts are adopting a wait-and-see approach, and many businesses say they simply want to get back to work. And where does the democracy movement go from here? Even before the security law, the coronavirus pandemic, and mass arrests sapped protests of their 2019 energy when millions of people took to the streets. Protesters say the law will make attending street gatherings even riskier, but that they will find other ways to continue to fight for democracy. Rick, a 16-year-old student who asked to use a pseudonym for his safety, says he disbanded a group supporting the protest movement that he ran at his school. He says he will hold meetings in secret instead. "What has changed is the strategy I will use to express my views," he says. Law, speaking from an undisclosed location, says he will continue to fight for democracy from abroad. However, the security legislation also says anyone who violates it anywhere in the world could be prosecuted. Pro-democracy lawmakers are hoping public disapproval of the law will translate into victory in September 6 elections for the city's legislative council, but some experts say the law could be used against candidates who do not demonstrate loyalty to Beijing, since anyone convicted under the new legislation will be barred from office. Wu Chi-wai, chair of the Democratic Party, says results may not be accepted by the central government, and he does not know whether our nomination will be disqualified, whether we will be disqualified during the election campaign, or whether we will be disqualified even if we get elected. The effects will also be felt outside Hong Kong, says Wasserstrom, and could deter professionals from moving there. Governments across the world have begun to implement punitive measures. Canada suspended its extradition treaty with the territory. The UK has offered millions of Hong Kongers a path to citizenship, and several other nations are considering changes to help them relocate. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the Trump administration will largely eliminate policy exemptions that underpin Hong Kong's special trade status with the U.S. Global tech companies, including Google and Facebook, have announced they will temporarily halt processing requests for user data from Hong Kong police, pending review of the law. For now, authorities are already using the new legislation on protesters. 10 people were arrested for offenses under the law July 1, including several holding pro-independence flags and leaflets. Most were granted bail. But quashing the ideals that Hong Kongers hold in private will not be so easy, says Rick, the student. "My will to fight against the government did not change." In Turkey, remaking a museum as a mosque. Sarah Fetin was at home under coronavirus lockdown May 29 when Quranic verses were recited beneath the normally silent minarets of Istanbul's Hagia Sophia. The reading, to mark the 567th anniversary of the Ottoman conquest of the city, lingered in his mind weeks after he returned to the courtyard outside Turkey's most visited attraction. Hagia Sophia officially belongs to Turkey, Sarah Fetin said, outside the UNESCO World Heritage Site, where he has sold Simit bread for 15 years. But we have to understand that people come to visit it from many different countries. We have to let them see and feel their history, too. Like other vendors, he declined to give his full name so he could speak freely. A seat of power for Orthodox Christians for almost 1,000 years, the Hagia Sophia became a mosque in 1453 after the Ottomans breached Constantinople's walls. In 1934, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who envisioned modern Turkey as a secular nation, ordered it turned into a museum. But in July, a court is set to rule on whether the Atatürk-era decree can be annulled, paving the way for the Hagia Sophia to again be a mosque. Orthodox Christians in Greece and Russia were aghast, while U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo urged Turkey to keep the Hagia Sophia a museum to show it respected pluralism. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan responded that such reactions were tantamount to a direct attack on our sovereignty. Domestically, the status of the Hagia Sophia strikes at the heart of the battle between Turkey's past and a future embodied by Erdogan's brand of religious nationalism. What the president proposes to do is a reversal of Atatürk's commitment to secularism, says Soner Kagapte, author of Erdogan's Empire, flooding Turkey's public space with his own understanding of religion. Polls suggest slightly more Turkish people support the Hagia Sophia becoming a mosque than oppose it, but a majority think the debate is primarily a distraction. It's a bluff, like poker, says Mehmet, 60, who owns a shop near Sarah Fetin's Simit trolley. There's no need to convert the building, he says. Did we fill all the other mosques in Turkey? Others worried that changing the Hagia Sophia's status might dissuade foreigners from visiting, hurting an industry already reeling from the pandemic. Look around, says Sami Bozbey, a trilingual guide scanning the courtyard for tourists. Everybody's struggling. And that column was written by Joseph Hinks in Istanbul. From the news ticker, a trio of very short articles, Trump plans American Heroes Park, with monuments a flashpoint in the conversation about inequality in the U.S., President Trump called for the construction of a national garden of American heroes. His July 3 executive order mandates the park include statues of historical and modern figures from Frederick Douglass to Antonin Scalia. Bolsonaro tests positive for COVID-19. Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, 65, confirmed July 7 he has COVID-19. He took the test, his fourth, on July 6 after developing symptoms. The populist leader has downplayed the risks of the coronavirus, calling it a little flu. His country's the second worst affected in the world. ICE, ICE in caps, releases new foreign student rules. Foreign students will be barred from staying in the U.S. to take classes at colleges that have switched to a fully online learning model, according to rules announced July 6 by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Harvard and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology sued over the new policy July 8. Here's the milestones column. Died country singer and band leader Charlie Daniels, July 6 at 83. Reopened the Louvre Museum in Paris, home of the Mona Lisa, after a nearly four-month closure, July 6. Extended the deadline for Paycheck Protection Program loan applications after President Trump signed a new law July 4. $130 billion in funds remains to be distributed. Apologized a Kansas newspaper owner and local GOP official July 5 for posting a cartoon that appeared to equate a statewide order to wear masks with the Holocaust. Arrested Jeffrey Epstein associate Ghislaine Maxwell by the FBI, charged with facilitating and participating in his sexual abuse of minors, July 2, observed record high average temperatures in the Siberian Arctic for the month of June, per EU data. Resigned David Clark, New Zealand's health minister, July 2. He admitted to breaking coronavirus lockdown rules imposed in late March and drew public anger for appearing to blame quarantine lapses on a popular official. Bought Postmates by Uber for $2.65 billion, subject to regulatory approval, per a July 6 announcement. And died Ennio Morricone, cinematic soundscaper. This article by Danny Elfman. The 20th century was the era of film music, and the world just lost one of that century's true giants. Ask a dozen film composers to name their heroes, and you'll get many different answers, but I would confidently bet that one name would be on every single list, the name of a true, undeniable musical genius, Ennio Morricone. But Morricone, who died at 91, July 6, was more than a musical hero. He was an icon. What really set him apart were his absolutely unique sensibilities. His imprint on cinema music's culture was so strong, entire genres were defined by him. His 1960s compositions for Sergio Leone's westerns like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly entered the popular culture so deeply, almost everyone knows their sound, even without being aware of it. And countering that highly idiosyncratic music were scores so lushly romantic, like that of Once Upon a Time in America. They redefined what truly emotional and purely evocative film music could aim for. His was the high mark. His work goes beyond the movies he composed for and will be deeply embedded in the art of film music for as long as there is film. He will be missed, but his music will not be forgotten. And Elfman, who wrote this short article, is an Oscar-nominated film composer. And also died Nick Cordero, Broadway star. Before COVID-19, actor Nick Cordero was in the prime of his life. His wife, Amanda Klutz, had recently given birth to their first child, and the young family had moved west after Cordero accepted a role in a play in Los Angeles. Then came the pandemic. Cordero, who according to Klutz had no pre-existing health conditions, contracted the disease in March. He spent the rest of his life in the hospital, facing secondary lung infections, mini strokes, and an amputation. And as Klutz shared his daily progress on social media, became one recognizable face of a global crisis. On July 5, 95 days after he fell ill, Cordero died. He was 41. Friends remembered Cordero, who was nominated for a Tony Award in 2014 for his portrayal of a tap-dancing gangster in Bullets Over Broadway, as a vivacious performer, and his family recalled a devoted father and husband. He was everyone's friend, loved to listen, help, especially talk, said Klutz. As states press forward with reopening, close friend Zach Braff had a message for the public. Don't believe the actor wrote on Twitter, that COVID only claims the elderly and infirm. That column was by Billy Perigo. And again, under the brief news and the heading Nation, as COVID-19 soars, Miami resists reclosing. This is by Vera Bergengruen. And there's a photo here in color. It looks like Miami. There's a palm tree hovering over a bunch of what look like beach umbrellas, but it's really diners in an alfresco mode outside, probably a white and multicolored trimmed high-rise, because there are lights under the umbrellas, strung under the umbrellas, and they're reflecting off the windows of that particular white building in the background. Two people are in the foreground. It looks like they're sharing a large drink, which is the size of a punch bowl. They are in a restaurant at Miami Beach, June 26. It had been barely 6 weeks since Michael Beltran and his staff reopened his Miami restaurants when he had to sit them down again and tell them the bad news. Despite all their efforts, working feverish 20-hour days to reconfigure the spaces for new guidelines amid the rush to reopen, Beltran was now being forced to close again. I had to look them in the eye and say, "You did everything right, but you are not going to have a job Wednesday," says the chef and restaurant owner. It is soul-crushing. Florida, which now has one of the fastest-growing COVID-19 caseloads in the nation, is struggling to balance its fresh spike with the cost of reclosing. In the early months of the crisis, things had looked good, despite predictions that spring break crowds, a large elderly population, and a delayed lockdown would make it a major hot spot. Florida was spared the worst of the pandemic that has killed more than 131,000 Americans, much more than that as of today. As the state came out of lockdown in early May, President Donald Trump repeatedly praised its governor, Ron DeSantis, saying he was doing a spectacular job. A month later, the number of confirmed cases spiked dramatically. The number of coronavirus patients filling Miami-Dade County's hospitals doubled in the past 2 weeks to more than 1,600. July 4, Floridians accounted for more than a fifth of all new COVID-19 cases in the country. In a rush to curb the spread, officials temporarily closed beaches, reimposed curfews, and issued a countywide mandatory mask order in Miami-Dade, but it was not enough. July 6, Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Ximenes abruptly announced restaurants, gyms, event venues would have to shut back down again. A drastic attempt to break through the false sense of security many Floridians have lived with for months. Hours later, he backtracked to allow some outdoor dining. Simply relying on public compliance was clearly not working, says Miami Commissioner Ken Russell. But it is hard to impress the severity of the danger on those who've been living as if the worst has passed. Local officials are still struggling to reel in residents and tourists crowding waterfront parks and busy restaurants, pleading with them to take the surge of infections seriously. On a recent near 100-degree day, police officers on South Beach alternated between issuing warnings and handing out masks, which many people promptly peeled off. Boats clogged the waterways over the July 4 holiday weekend, some packed with dozens of partiers. In the Coconut Grove neighborhood, lines of people, many unmasked, snaked by outdoor cafes, greeting one another, Miami style, with a cheek kiss. Florida is not the only state in this predicament. At least 20 other states have had to pause or roll back their reopening plans as hospitalizations rise. "How do you do a lockdown backwards?" asks Dr. Eileen Marty, an infectious disease expert at Florida International University. Marty and some local officials partly blame state officials' mixed messaging for Floridians brushing off the new emergency orders. "We have got leaders that refuse to acknowledge how serious this is," she says. More than perhaps any other governor, DeSantis has tied his political future to Trump's when it comes to the handling of the pandemic. He's resisted pressure to issue a statewide mandatory mask order and echoed the president's line that the economic damage of a prolonged lockdown could do more harm than the virus. He's angrily pushed back on allegations from a former state employee that Florida manipulated data to drum up support for reopening. At an Oval Office sit-down with Trump in late April that some of in the state warned was a premature victory tour, he boasted that despite the draconian orders issued in other states, Florida has done better. That declaration has not aged well. In Miami, the lines of cars outside drive-through testing centers are growing. Hospitals warn they'll be inundated if cases continue to rise. Some 56 ICUs across the state were projected to reach capacity July 8. And with no end in sight, many newly shuttered businesses say they will not be able to weather an ongoing seesaw between case spikes and hasty reopenings. Why even start the process, Beltran, the chef, wonders aloud. I hope those people that did not abide by rules are happy with themselves. From the brief Nation, while we still don't know how often police kill people in America, and this is by Vera Bergengroin. There's a photo here. It looks like armed militia walking through a cloud of smoke. It says State Patrol on the front of their uniforms. There are about a dozen people here. They are completely covered in heavy body clothing, including their knees, their chests, their shoulders, their back, their heads. They're wearing helmets. They look like welders' helmets. They're quite substantial looking with a clear mask in front. One person has the mask flipped up so that it is atop the helmet. Some are carrying weapons, and I can't determine what the weapons are. They're long and they're round like tubes. I don't know if they're firearms or some other type of club. There's just a little bit of greenery in the front of this photograph. Otherwise, it's very bleak. It just looks like clouds forming around these darkly dressed individuals. One, get police departments. So this is the answer to the question posed in the title, why we still don't know how often police kill people in America. One, get police departments across the country to report when their officers use lethal force or seriously injure someone. Two, collect that information in a national database. Three, release those statistics to the public. That simple formula has been at the heart of nearly every comprehensive police reform proposal in modern U.S. history, and for good reason. Police chiefs and community organizers, Republicans and Democrats, federal lawmakers and local leaders all agree. A comprehensive database of use of force incidents is key to fighting racial injustice in law enforcement. But that bipartisan agreement, as well as a 26-year-old federal law mandating the creation of a database and a 5-year effort by the FBI to build one, have all failed to produce reliable data on how and when America's police officers use force against its own people. I've been around so long, and it seems they just keep rediscovering the wheel, says Jeffrey Alpert, a criminology professor at the University of South Carolina. When he testified at the Justice Department June 19, He covered the same thing I talked about for 30 years in similar meetings during the Bush, Clinton, and Obama administrations. He says it's always been obvious. If we don't know the data, how do we identify the problem? The only way forward is with evidence, but we continue to spin in circles. As of May, only 40% of police departments across the country had submitted information to the FBI's National Use of Force Data Collection, the most recent effort to collect this data, an agency spokeswoman told Time. The database, which began collecting the information in January 2019, has run into the same basic issue that has stalled previous attempts. It relies on voluntary participation, which results in an incomplete and skewed picture of how police officers are using force across the country. To fix the problem, participation should be mandatory for every law enforcement agency, Stephen Kastevans, head of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee June 16. But truly mandatory reporting would require an act of Congress, and legal experts tell Time it is not clear. Federal lawmakers have the power to require state and local departments to comply. The nationwide protests that followed George Floyd's killing by a police officer who had a record of conduct complaints have revived efforts to collect this data. A June 16 executive order from President Trump and competing police reform bills put forward by House Democrats and Senate Republicans all seek to create a more complete database by tying federal grant funding to regular reporting. But police chiefs, former FBI and DOJ statisticians, and law enforcement analysts say unless lawmakers acknowledge and address the roadblocks that stalled previous efforts, the current momentum is likely to end in the same disappointment. Of course, addressing those roadblocks is easier said than done. Offering grants to cooperative agencies, the tactic favored by Trump and legislators, might work to some extent. Almost everyone's getting federal funding of some type, and they certainly do not want to risk that, so it can be an effective tool, says Matthew Hickman, chair of the Criminal Justice Department at Seattle University and a former statistician at Bureau of Justice Statistics. But that's still less effective than making collection and reporting mandatory. Trump's executive order is almost identical to a law that already exists, a provision in the 1994 crime bill signed by President Bill Clinton. Both direct the U.S. Attorney General to gather use of force data and periodically make it public, though neither actually requires police departments to provide that data. Following the 1994 law, the Justice Department's strategy was to expand its Police Public Contact Survey, which asks U.S. residents about their encounters with police. The latest report available from 2015 polled 70,959 residents, but still contained no comprehensive data on use of force incidents. The dearth of information has led to open frustration by the nation's top law enforcement officials. It is ridiculous that I cannot tell you how many people were shot by the police in this country last week, last year, last decade. It is ridiculous. Then FBI Director James Comey admitted in February 2015. In the spring of that year, the Obama administration launched a separate FBI initiative. The program convened its first task force in 2016 and ran a pilot program in 2017. It established a help desk hotline and an email address for police officers submitting data and developed a web application meant to simplify uploading cases in bulk. The FBI's National Use of Force Data Collection, rolled out to great fanfare in November 2018, established what the FBI hailed as the first mechanism for collecting nationwide statistics related to use of force incidents. But despite all that, as of this spring, fewer than half of U.S. police departments were enrolled in the FBI's program and sharing data. According to an FBI pilot study reviewed by Time, the first public report of the database's statistics was scheduled for March 2019. It never materialized. An FBI spokesperson tells Time the first publication is now expected to be this summer. An FBI overview of the program listed a few reasons police departments would be reluctant to participate in the database, including the time burden on officers, roughly 38 minutes per incident. They made it a federal law, but Congress did not appropriate any funds to actually do the job, says Seattle University's Hickman. It is not like you flip a switch and data flows in from 18,000 agencies. It is challenging. All of these problems contribute to widespread agreement that no matter what happens in Washington, for now the most effective legislation is likely to happen at the state level. Some states, including California, Colorado, Connecticut, and Texas, already gather and report statewide policing data, which they can then forward on to the FBI as well. Robert Stevenson, executive director of the Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police, says state lawmakers pushing for more transparency were surprised when he told them a federal program to collect this data already existed. Many have never even heard of the FBI's national database collection, even within law enforcement, he said. Lawmakers in Michigan agreed the state's police departments would report to the federal FBI database, and those numbers would also be released to the public. After getting the Michigan Sheriff's Association on board, 368 agencies, making up 90% of law enforcement officers in Michigan, signed up to submit data on use of force. In the wake of recent protests, Michigan officials said they would release the state's police use of force data, which had been gathered in the joint effort with the FBI. Police departments across the country should realize collecting and analyzing this data serves everyone, Stevenson says. Now we will have the data to have that conversation, to actually lay it out and say, look, we are not massacring people left and right, and here is where we can do better. This gives us the opportunity to have that informed conversation without misperceptions and misinformation. Meanwhile, the reforms being debated in Congress and their competing efforts to create a better database remain in stalemate. June 24, Senate Democrats blocked debate on the Republican bill, which includes a data collection proposal, for not going far enough. The following day, Democrats passed a sweeping police overhaul bill in the House, which includes a provision for a national database that would collect this information in more detail and make it public, but that is unlikely to get past the Senate. Like previous efforts, neither bill includes a legal mandate that could be tested in court to answer the question of whether police can be compelled to report their data to the federal government. Even so, advocates hope the resulting legislation will move the country toward finally having a fuller picture of where and how often U.S. police officers use force and on whom. I have to be tentatively optimistic, Alpert says. I do not want to be here in 10 years when we have another horrible event and everyone relives the same thing again. We have got to see progress. We at least have to be able to say, last time we got step one and step two done, what is next? from within the view with the caption Health, The Power of Masks by Gavin Yamy. At long last, we have made a truly game-changing scientific breakthrough in preventing the spread of COVID-19. We have found a disease control tool that, when used properly, can reduce transmission by somewhere between 50% and 85%. The tool is cheap and remarkably low-tech. You can even make one at home. If this tool were a vaccine or medicine, we'd be high-fiving one another and popping the champagne, knowing we had discovered a crucial means to help prevent the spread of the pandemic. I'm talking, of course, about face masks. Face masks block the spread of respiratory droplets that can carry the novel coronavirus, but just as with so many other aspects of the response to COVID-19, including mass testing, contact tracing, and the early use of stay-at-home orders, the U.S. is once again squandering this opportunity. In many countries that have so far successfully controlled their COVID-19 epidemics, health experts, politicians, and the public have fully embraced the use of face masks without controversy. A recent study found that nations like Hong Kong, South Korea, Taiwan, Vietnam, where masks were widely used soon after their COVID-19 outbreaks began, were more likely to keep death rates low, fewer than 6 deaths per million people, and to have shorter outbreaks. Now, just here is a small inset photo in color of a group of people. Some are sitting right next to each other on park benches. Some are standing in a crowded situation. They're in the open air. One can see blue sky all around them. And one woman who's wearing a bright red shirt and a white visor and sunglasses is holding out her hand as a New York City Parks employee hands out masks as the city moves into phase 2 of reopening. Now, the woman with the bright red shirt is already wearing a bright red, white, and blue mask, but perhaps she's taking another just in case from the young woman dressed in park employee's garb with dark pants and a green shirt and a green cap, and she's wearing a pink, white, and blue mask. And back to the text, yet in the U.S., where the death rate from COVID-19 is now 394 per million people, face masks have been weaponized for partisan purposes, taking their cues from President Trump, who's refused to appear on camera wearing a face mask at the time of this writing, and has said Americans who wear masks are doing so to show their disapproval of him. Many of his supporters now see wearing a face mask as an affront to personal liberty. As a result of this alarming polarization, only 23 states and the District of Columbia are mandating face masks in public. Only 4, Massachusetts, Maryland, Texas, West Virginia, have GOP governors. Some Republican-led states are trying to subvert local measures that require masks. Rejecting face masks inevitably means embracing more COVID-19 cases and deaths. One U.S. study found states with mask mandates had more rapid declines in daily growth rates of COVID-19 and estimated that mask use had prevented up to 450,000 cases by May 22. While researchers at the University of Washington now predict the U.S. could reach 180,000 COVID-19 deaths by October, they say we could prevent 33,000 of these deaths if at least 95% of people wore masks. That's right, we can avert deaths of 33,000 of our parents, grandparents, siblings, co-workers, teachers, bus drivers, nurses, and store workers by just sticking a $1 piece of cloth over our noses and mouths. So what is stopping us? One problem, the me-first culture in the U.S., in which anti-maskers claim their right to go around unmasked in public matters more than saving lives. What they don't seem to get is that while masks may protect the wearer, the more important reason to wear them is to protect others. What's more, the higher the proportion of people who wear masks, the lower the risk the coronavirus will spread through the community, akin to herd immunity after vaccination. This is why it's so important for governments to issue and enforce mask mandates. COVID-19 cases are on the rise again in 40 states, according to the Associated Press, and are growing exponentially in states like Arizona, Texas, and Florida that acted too quickly to reopen businesses. The only way to control the dramatic rise in these hard-hit states will be to reinstate lockdowns and mandatory social distancing. Mass masking is not the way to end a huge surge in COVID-19. Instead, it's one of the ways we can help avoid repeated cycles of surge, lockdown, release. There's plenty of evidence from countries around the world that widespread mask wearing, in combination with social distancing, hand washing, and track and trace testing, will allow us to more safely do the things we so desperately want and need to do. Go back to work, reopen schools, see friends and family, and rebuild our economy. Wearing a face mask is not a sign of weakness. It is an act of solidarity, an expression that all of us, Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, have a role to play in defeating one of the greatest challenges we have faced in our lifetimes. Gavin Yamy, who wrote this article, is a physician and professor of global health and public policy at Duke University. Making an investment, here's another trio of very short items, a paragraph apiece. Martin Luther King Jr. dreamed of guaranteed income as a way of combating economic insecurity. Now 11 U.S. mayors have formed a coalition to work on that issue. Against a similar backdrop of racial and economic unrest, we mayors are bringing that dream to life, they write. Temporary relief. The Supreme Court ruling in June, Medical v. Russo, was a win for abortion rights, but Catherine Colbert and Julie F. Kaye, lawyers who've argued major abortion cases in the U.S. and abroad, say it is not enough. We cannot be complacent and rely upon the federal courts to preserve women's autonomy. Vision for the future. As Israel prepares to annex part of the West Bank, Salam Fayyad, former prime minister of the Palestinian National Authority, argues the Palestinian leadership should rethink the 1988 peace initiative and its framework for a two-state solution. We need an agenda that empowers us to become the masters of our own destiny. This is a risk report. Ethiopia faces a precarious political moment by Ian Bremmer. The June 29 murder of activist, singer, and political icon Hakalu Hundessa has ignited violence across Addis Ababa and other Ethiopian cities. This is the latest chapter in this country's tumultuous journey from authoritarian rule toward genuine democracy. Reports of vandalism, arson, robbery, and murder have made national headlines. Some 1,200 people have been arrested. In the city of Ambo, police have shot and killed at least 9 people, some of them mourners at Hundessa's funeral. Ethiopia, Africa's second most populous nation, is no stranger to unrest. The country's constitution divides Ethiopia into ethnically based territories, but many disputes over boundaries have never been resolved. Oromo, the largest of Ethiopia's many ethnic groups, make up about one-third of the country's 112 million people, but they say they've been excluded from holding national power. In 2014, in the Oromo-dominated city of Ambo, university students began demonstrations against a plan to expand Addis Ababa, the nation's capital, into the surrounding countryside and onto land that's part of the Oromo homeland. Confrontations between protesters turned deadly, triggering demonstrations across the country against its autocratic government. For Oromos, Hundessa's music provided the protest soundtrack. The expansion plans were scrapped, but only after hundreds were killed and thousands arrested. Outsiders were startled by the violence because Ethiopia was considered an economic success story. In the decade before the authoritarian government finally gave up power in 2018, Ethiopia's economy grew at 9.9% per year, and building projects produced some of sub-Saharan Africa's best roads, bridges, and electricity grids. But the spoils were not shared equally. Ethiopia is still a poor country. Unemployment among young people remains high. The protests finally forced Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn to step down. Enter Abiy Ahmed, who was sworn in as Prime Minister in April 2018. Abiy committed himself to national reconciliation and political openness. He lifted the state of emergency, welcomed greater press freedom, released political prisoners, and invited dissidents to return from exile. He ended 20 years of war with neighboring Eritrea. For all this, Abiy was awarded the 2019 Nobel Peace Prize. Then his job got harder. Abiy, an Oromo, has offered a vision of Ethiopian national identity that transcends ethnic divisions. Observers say some Oromos have been emboldened by Abiy's rise and have attacked other groups in revenge. Freeing political prisoners and welcoming dissent meant opening a Pandora's box of tribal grievance. When violence escalated after Hundessa's murder, Abiy shut down the internet. Without obvious suspects or clear motives for the killing, Abiy has hinted that Hundessa may have been murdered by Egyptian security agents acting on orders from Cairo to stir up trouble. Egypt and Ethiopia are locked in a dispute over construction of the controversial Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, an Ethiopian project which Egyptians say will divert water from the Nile. Calls for war have echoed across Egyptian media and Twitter, though negotiations continue. But Prime Minister Abiy may just be looking for a scapegoat that can unite Ethiopians against a perceived common enemy. Unfortunately, the anger and fear in Ethiopia's largest cities now has few outlets. The internet remains down, and Abiy has postponed a national election scheduled for August for 1 year in response to COVID-19. The streets are the only place where the Ethiopian people can air a growing list of grievances. From Quick Talk, more short items. Doctoral student Lily Sherless discusses her research into the term social distancing and its surprising history. How did the term social distancing evolve? It is used as a euphemism for class and race in the 19th century. In the 1920s, the social distance scale, describing comfort levels between people of different races, becomes a social science tool. During the AIDS crisis, it is used to describe misguided fears of contagion. It is not until 2004 that the CDC picks it up to talk about airborne illness. How did the idea become part of the study of race? The social distance scale turns up in the wake of the summer of 1919, especially the Chicago race riots, in order to try to make sense of race. It makes it seem like people fit very neatly into these groups. It is just this huge reduction. What do you hope people take away from your research? How much the term has been used to justify elites sequestering themselves from marginalized or disenfranchised folks in the U.S. across 200 years? And Olivia B. Waxman wrote that story about the origins of social distance. This is an excerpt from an article about best-selling novelist David Mitchell, who visits the age of rock. And this is written by Dan Stewart. In David Mitchell's new novel, Utopia Avenue, a member of the 1960s psychedelic folk rock band that gives the book its name is asked by an interviewer which category its eclectic music falls into. You're like a zoologist asking a platypus, are you a duck-like otter or an otter-like duck, replies Jasper, the group's virtuosic guitar player. Like the platypus, I don't care. We make music we like. We hope others like it too. That's it. It is hard not to read this as a wink at Mitchell's own reputation for genre fluidity, given a body of work that encompasses historical fiction, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, Bildungsroman, Black Swan Green, science fiction, The Bone Clocks, and a combination of the above, Cloud Atlas, for which he is best known. So I asked the novelist over a recent video call, are you a platypus? The 51-year-old chuckles, all artists are. Actually, all human beings are. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.